As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal.
I'm happy to say that joining us now is Bill Dudley, the former New York Fed president and currently Bloomberg opinion columnist, and so much more. Bill, great to catch up with you, sir. I just want to reflect on something we heard about 5 minutes ago from David Rosenberg, pushing back against this idea that inflation will be stickier on the way down. Bill, I know you listened to some of that conversation. What did you make of it?
I agree with David that inflation is going to take a longer time to corral than people think. I mean, people are focusing so much on the improvement in goods inflation. That was well expected. As the economy has opened up, the composition of demand has shifted away from goods back to services. So, of course, goods prices are going to be weaker. But services inflation is really high, and the labor market is still really tight. We're still having job gains well above what's consistent with a loosening labor market. So the Fed's got a lot of work to do. I think the big thing about what the next year is going to look like, it's really in the Fed's control. The Fed is going to keep policy tight enough for long enough to get inflation back down. And the outcome we get for the economy is going to depend on how much that actually hurts economic growth. I think there is going to be a recession. I think it's going to last quite a while. But it's not going to be a dangerous recession in the sense that the Fed can relent at any time and end that recession, which is very unusual compared to past cycles. This is not a recession that's going to be driven by, financial instability. It's not going to be a recession driven by, household and corporate balance sheets being overextended. It's a recession that's completely induced by a tight monetary policy regime. And so the Fed can end it when they think the time is right.
Given the strength that we've continued to see in the economy, and Evan Brown of UBS Asset Management was talking about them seeing it sustained through the first half of next year, do you think the Fed could go even higher than you previously thought in terms of a benchmark rate?
I'm thinking the peak is probably in the 5 to 5.5% range, just for the point you just made, that the news will probably be stronger for longer. It'll be very hard for the Fed just to stop if we're still, at an unemployment rate below 4% and, underlying inflation is still running, 4% or higher. So I think that it will get a series of, smaller rate hikes, but that will probably push us up above 5%. But clearly the Fed's strategy here is they're stressing the longer rather than the ever higher. So I think once we get to 5.25, 5.5, I think they'll relent, and then they'll just sit there and wait for that restrictive monetary policy to slow the economy down, generate more slack in the labor market, and that will gradually push both wage inflation and services price inflation down.
This is what Fed officials have been saying, Bill. I mean, this is basically pretty much in line with what they're saying. The market is not buying it. They are still pricing in rate cuts by the end of next year. What does the Fed have to see to start becoming less restrictive? And I don't mean that with respect to keeping rates where they are. I mean, actually lowering them in a significant way.
Well, they have to be highly confident that they're going to be able to achieve their 2% inflation objective. Doesn't mean that inflation has to be at 2% when they finally relent, but they have to be highly confident. Now, what does highly confident mean? It means that they have to see significant slack developing in the labor market that brings down wage inflation to the 3 to 4% range. And they need to see the inflation pressures be much less persistent and broad as they are today. So they need to see probably inflation in the sort of 3% range headed down. And once they've accomplished both of those things, then maybe they can start to relent. But I think it's going to take quite some time because the economy still has a considerable forward momentum. And it's going to be sustained by the past inflation that we've seen. For example, Social Security recipients are going to get an 8.7% increase in their checks come January. And they're going to go out and spend a bunch of that money, and that's going to keep the economy moving along. And that's going to make it hard for the Fed to restrain things.
Bill, you wrote yesterday on Bloomberg Opinion that the Fed shouldn't raise its inflation target. You said changing the objective now would be bad for the economy and for the central bank's own credibility. But I did wonder when that got published. I wondered why you wrote it. Are you really worried that they might actually go through with that next year?
Well, I wrote it because I'm being asked about it all the time. And so I thought I should write down what I think the right answer is. You know, the argument for raising the inflation target is really sort of two potential arguments. Number one, can't hit two. So let's make the objective a little bit easier. That's obviously not a very good argument. The other argument's a little bit better, which is we have a higher inflation target, then the peak in short-term interest rates during the cycle will be higher and we'll have more room to ease when a recession hits. And so there'll be less risk of being pinned at the zero lower bound for interest rates. I think that risk, though, has diminished considerably because the peak in short-term rates this cycle is probably going to be above 5%. So the Federal Reserve has plenty of ammunition to cut rates in an environment where their inflation target is still 2%. So I think this idea that the zero lower bound continues to be this huge risk and is a big constraint on monetary policy, I think that's overstated at this point.
But Bill, how concerned are you that the Fed will not have the same resolve in the middle of next year to keep rates where they are if we do see the unemployment rate going up and we do see the U.S. entering into recession?
Well, I think the committee, it'll be interesting to see whether the committee is united 12 months from now as it is today. I think Chair Powell means what he says, that he wants to behave in a way that he's not like Arthur Burns, so he doesn't have to be like Paul Volcker. But whether he can keep the rest of the committee along with him as the unemployment rate goes up, and the trade-offs between the two objectives of the Fed, price stability and maximum sustainable employment, become more in conflict with one another. So I think we don't know the answer to that. I'm hopeful that Powell will carry the day.
I remember when inflation was sub 2% and people were talking about raising the inflation target then. Do you remember that?
I do.
We should raise it to 3.
Absolutely.
Because then they'd be more ambitious and people would believe they're committed to getting inflation higher. Then they might hit 2.
Yeah. Do you remember when they were also talking about free money and modern monetary theory? We did that too.
Crazy times. Bill Dudley, thank you. Appreciate it as always.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Alongside Lisa Abramowitz, I'm Jonathan Ferrow, together with Alicia Levine of BNY Mellon. Great to have you with us in the studio, Alicia. What is more important, the Fed speak or the data?
So I think it's the data, and I think it's precisely the labor data, because the Fed has explicitly targeted the labor market here. As inflation has remained higher and stickier and not transitory, they've been talking about the labor market, trying to get rid of job openings, the beverage curve, which is the JOLTS data, and then, of course, the wage data. And I think if you don't see softness in either of those two reads, it's going to be difficult for
the
market.
You know where this is going? Are you saying that good news is bad news in the labor market data?
I hate to say that, but we're back to this world. I mean, we're back to the world where a softer real economy will be more pleasing for the Fed and means that whatever their target is, 5 to 5.25, 5 to 5.5, is still the right target. The issue is if you get no softness in the labor market, and let's face it, we haven't seen any softness in the labor market in the aggregate data, then we're going to have to go higher. Because in the end, every Fed hiking cycle ends when the Fed funds rate is above CPI, and we are not there yet.
Where are you thinking that the Fed funds is going? So we're going to get a summary of economic projections in the next Fed meeting. At the last Fed meeting where we had an SCP, which was back in September, they pushed the 23 dot from 3.8 to 4.6. I think most people assume it goes to 5. Is there scope for surprise there?
There is some scope for it to be a little bit higher than that, just because, as I've said, the services inflation is not rolling over, and the sticky services inflation is not rolling over. So while headline is, and clearly the goods inflation has peaked and coming down hard, services has not, and that's 60% of CPI. So I think there's room to go higher. I think as you get higher on Fed funds, you're going to see a wider dispersion, and you're going to see some conversation in the FOMC about where we go from here. I think the easy part of the hiking cycle is, in a sense, behind us after this December meeting. And after that, you're going to start getting some dissents.
What do you think is going to be the bigger surprise for markets? If we get softer than expected jobs prints, or stronger or hotter than expected jobs prints?
So I think the biggest surprise would be if we got hotter here. We're having really high number of announcements of layoffs, and yet it's not showing up in the aggregate data at all. I mean, those Thursday morning new claims data are hitting new lows, or barely moving off lows. So it's not hitting the data yet. So I think if the numbers were hotter, it would be a surprise here.
People are talking about short and shallow, and we've been talking about this all morning. That what is the consequence of this type of recession? How long will it last? And we were just speaking with Bill Dudley, who agrees with the idea of a longer and shallow type of recession. Is that an okay scenario for risk assets?
So that's a great question. And this goes back to the difference between the real economy and risk assets. So even in a shallow recession, you can still have S&P earnings declines of 20%. And I'll just point to 2001 as a great example of that. Risk assets did not do well, even with a short and shallow recession. So there is still risk here. And in the end, this year was about rates and multiple compression and the correlation between the bond and equity market, the worst being since 1931, that this is the transition year. Next year is, okay, now your rates are higher. What does it mean for the real economy? And that's, I think, we really have not priced in. I'm not the only one saying this, but it is true that the earnings really are too high and not essentially reflecting 500 basis points of tightening within 10 or 11 months. I mean, we've never really hiked this fast, and we haven't seen the effect yet. So that is down the road, and that is sure to come.
Let's talk about leadership. Is it too early to talk about potential leadership for next year or not?
So in a funny way, we have started to price in a recession around June, then again September, and now we're starting to price in a recovery. We haven't even gotten
the recession.
To the recession. We haven't even gotten to realistic earnings numbers. So I don't think it's too early yet. I mean, there are certain sectors, there are certain companies that are just beaten down and left for dead. Okay. And that is where you can go shopping for your stocks. Like, we think the bond market is going to look much better next year simply because all the work was done this year. And historically, if you look at the 10 worst starts to the year in the bond market, you have a positive year the following year. And it makes sense if you think about it. I mean, it's related to the rolling over and the inversion of the yield curve.
You mentioned the early 2000s. Some of those names were left for dead for a long, long time.
Yep.
Can you help me understand what should be left for dead for a long, long time?
So speculation should be left for dead, right? So anything where it's multiple of revenue or, that no earnings, that will be left for dead probably forever. And I would suggest there'll be some consolidation in those areas. But that's not something to look forward to, because there's many of these assets still have a ways to go. We're not there yet. Left for dead is when you're down 80 to 90% from the peak. So if you are in a speculative asset or a speculative name, and you're hoping for, that it's going to, the market will stabilize one day, you actually still probably have another 20% to go on the downside here.
What percent of the overall market cap of the S&P is that speculative sort of quadrant that's going to be left for dead permanently?
I think it's about 10% here. It's about 10%. I think that some of the biggest risk, and we've talked about this, is the large cap names, which are still trading at higher multiples. You know, in the end, when you get a multiple compression year and you get the end of the you know, exuberance on the valuation side, you have to bring value investors back in to invest in these growth names. And some of our favorite growth names are still trading at pretty high multiples. And so the top of the market still has risk here. You can see it in how the overall market in the aggregate has traded, the Dow versus the NASDAQ, the Dow versus the S&P. I mean, the S&P is overly weighted, top 10 names, 29% of the index. A lot of those names are still not cheap, and they're still expensive.
I think Tom paid her to talk about the Dow.
Well, we like to talk about the equal weight.
Yeah, but it does make sense, though.
The same point.
It does. I think that it is a good point. Going forward, then, do you think that the potential for contagion is off the table, considering that we still have potentially more washout to go here?
So I think there's still a risk of sovereign debt issues in Europe. I think we are not through this winter. We are not through the nat gas problem of this winter. And then after this winter, there's a summer and another winter. And I think the market's very short-sighted in piecing this through and who's going to be paying for this and how it's going to be funded. These are not easy questions. And I think this is kind of an issue that's been left for dead because it's been a warmer than expected autumn in Europe. And so the reserves are high. But again, that's a one winter story. We don't have a plan yet moving forward. So I think there is some risk there. I think the contagion risk is lower, but not dead yet. I think that the Bitcoin blow up is likely to be contained. There clearly was some counterparty risk, but I don't think it was a big enough asset for it to have huge reverberations.
I agree with you on Europe. You've got to think about why the reserves are where they are. Nord Stream, are we going to have the same ability to build up those reserves through next summer? Doesn't seem so. Doesn't seem so right now.
What do you do also in an economy where the inflation is coming from something completely out of control of central banks and even of policymakers, because it's getting difficult for them to source enough natural gas from enough places over the longer term with contracts that aren't necessarily 10 or 20 years.
They worry about expectations. They worry about the second round of effects of inflation, going into wage negotiations, those kind of things. It's a tough spot for the Europeans. It will be next year as well, based on where people think the energy market's going.
Have people priced out some of that bear case, though, for Europe, based on how much the euro is traded?
Equities in Europe are up more than 20% off the lows.
Look at the European banks. The most exposed asset over the last decade has rallied enormously. So, you know, risk assets are back on, and the recovery is getting priced in. And the question is this a bear trap, right? Is this too early? Everybody likes picking the bottom and everybody thinks they have the turn.
Sure.
I just think that the nat gas, the funding, the sovereign debt issue, all related in Europe, is not over yet. And the wage issue, as you point out, we have a wage issue here. Let's talk about the rail strike. Okay, really quiet. Well, if rail workers were really concerned about a deepening recession, they probably wouldn't be fighting for higher wages.
Is the West Coast next? That's what I'd be asking. The ports negotiations, do they break down? I wonder if you're interested in a five-part dollar bond sale from Amazon, Alicia. I wonder if that gets you going. That headline just crossing the Bloomberg. Team USA, do they get it done later? Do they get it done, Team USA?
Such an exciting game.
Isn't
I'm going to
cool?
say yes.
There we go.
Yes.
Alicia Levine of BNY Mellon.
That's not conviction.
That's conviction. She's fired up. What
so
are you talking
excited.
About?
I'm going to say yes.
I'm going to say yes too. Joining us now, I'm pleased to say, is Evan Brown, Head of Multi-Asset Strategy at UBS Asset Management. Evan, always fantastic to catch up with you and the team. Let's just start with the core theme for you guys, which is that you think investors are going to be surprised by how resilient this US economy will continue to be, perhaps deep into 2023. Evan, can you walk us through the why and for how long you think we might be surprised?
Yeah, so I think we're in an environment where you still have a lot of excess savings on household balance sheets in aggregate. So we know that those excess savings are dwindling somewhat for some of the lower earners, but the biggest spenders in the economy are higher earners. You still have a very tight labor market for those lower earners, lower income earners, plus, and I think this is a very big deal, a big decline in gasoline prices. That's going to be a big support for the U.S. consumer. You've got a Social Security adjustment, cost of living adjustment that's going to effectively boost incomes. The states have a lot of excess savings themselves, and there's direct support for consumers coming through there. So what we're talking about is a reasonably healthy economy despite all the rate hikes that we've seen today.
Can you be just as constructive on earnings?
Yeah, I mean, I think as inflation comes down, that's going to weigh somewhat on earnings. But I think a lot of that is known, right? A lot of that, even if you haven't seen analyst expectations come down as much, everyone's talking about recession. Everyone's talking about earnings coming down. And so the surprise is that they hang in there, right? We're not talking about a boom in earnings. They're definitely coming down, but we are talking about them just kind of hanging in. And at this point, that's probably enough.
Do you think we could see the outcome for 2023 flipped from what people are expecting, which is a good first half and a really bad second half?
It could be, because I do think that the tightness of the labor market can continue, and that's going to keep the Fed on edge. There's a lot of narrative right now that, okay, the Fed's going to do another 50 basis point hike, another 25 basis point hike, and more or less be done. But if the labor market is staying tight, then there's a bias that the Fed has to, you know, kind of extend and do a few more 25 basis points hike. Can we get to a 5.5-6% expected terminal rate? I think we can. And ultimately, you know, that can be the thing that makes the economy crack down the road, but it's too early to trade that right now.
What does that mean in terms of the bond trade, given that so many people hid out in the long end? Does that mean that that could be fine for now and we could see that work for another couple months? But if we go to a 5-6% benchmark Fed funds rate, all of a sudden that trade gets blown up.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I do think a lot of the bond rally is a result of people kind of short covering. Everyone's been short bonds for a long time. And I think a lot of it, too, has been the round trip that we've seen from the UK transitioning from fiscal stimulus coming from the Truss administration to now Sunak and fiscal austerity. So that's putting downward pressure globally on yields. But all of that is kind of played out. And now we get to the point where, you know, growth is OK. Inflation is sticky. Fed might be doing more than people expect. And then right out there, you have the Bank of Japan, right, which at some point next year, probably in the first half, is going to be adjusting. And even if that's kind of known, that's really the last anchor that there is on bond yield. So I think almost even psychologically, that's going to be injecting some term premium in bond markets and perhaps leading to a renewed sell-off in duration.
Evan, if that's the case, where does that leave the dollar trade? Because I'd pick up on cable. You mentioned the UK. That went from 103.50 intraday lows of the year on September 26th to 120 right now. Similarly, we've had a turnaround in euro dollar as well. Evan, are you saying that dollar strength can kick back in too?
Yeah, I think it'll kick back in, but not to the same extent that we've seen for the bulk of this year. And the reason being that Europe, you know, the we all know that they're in recession or about to be in recession. They're going to be bouncing back. In fact, you're already seeing the confidence measure, consumer confidence, business confidence measure stabilize and in some cases turn. So you should get on a forward looking basis a little bit of bounce from Europe. You know, China, the path is bumpy, leaving zero COVID, but the destination is reopening. I mean, they're going to have to reopen in order to make sure that the economy just doesn't completely fall apart and that the government has the tax revenues to actually pursue their policies on commerce, prosperity and redistribution and the like. So the current situation is unsustainable in China. And so we'll pick up there. So if you're getting, you know, more support from Europe, more support from China, it's not just a U.S. driven economic story.
Evan, final forecast we want from you. Team USA against Iran, 2 p.m. Eastern time. What's the score?
U.S. is going to win 2-1. That's you can count on that.
There we go. There we go. UBS. You see, UBS likes to play ball. What was PIMCO about earlier?
You know,
baseball chat.
They're playing a different ball.
Baseball banter.
Yeah.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs – to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more. Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Joining us now is Vasilios Janakis, the head of European FX strategy over at Citi. Vasilios, great to catch up with you. Let's talk about what went right, or rather what went wrong for some of these calls around sterling, which is now pushed through 120.
Well, look, I think, first of all, there has been a fundamental reason in the sense that there has been the pricing out of the excessive risk premium related to the fiscal policies that were basically announced back at the end of September. And the second thing, you know, during that period, there was an enormous buildup of sterling shorts. Given the fact that we are now in an environment of relative dollar weakness, sterling has pushed higher, and you get the unwinding of these sterling shorts. As far as, I mean, if you want to gauge the direction of sterling, I wouldn't be looking at cable, because cable, it's going to be the mirror image of what the dollar is doing. It's got to bet at the dollar around one. I would be mostly looking at euro sterling, and, you know, I have to say I'm quite surprised that it's still hovering around 85, 86.
So you would reload sterling shorts, but against the euro?
Yes, absolutely. The trigger point for me to do that is that I think we need to reach a point at which positioning, especially by the speculative community, is reaching relatively neutral levels. We're getting quite close to that if you look at the CFTC data as well as our proprietary indices. But I'm quite confident in that call for euro sterling higher.
How much are you trying to move away from the dollar just in general in terms of your crosses, your pairs, just simply because the dollar story has been A, so dominant, and B, so unpredictable?
I think 2023 is going to be a year in which relative value is going to make sense from a trading perspective. And I think by far the biggest thing is going to be the housing market. On the back of very strong monetary policy tightening, one needs to identify the places where housing markets are most vulnerable. And in us, at least in Europe, if you look, Sweden and the UK are by far the most vulnerable ones. But aside from that, I'd like to add that as far as the dollar call is concerned, I have to say that I'm inclined to believe that we're an inflection point in the dollar. It's the Fed, and it's also the elephant in the room, which is China.
Inflection point to a weaker dollar.
To a weaker dollar, yes. I think if you identify the different states of the world, what really matters for the dollar is basically what the Fed is doing, but also what global growth is doing. And I think the market is sniffing that basically the genie is out of the bottle as far as China reopening is concerned.
So what do you think happens with China? What's your base case? Do you think full reopening?
Well, it depends what you mean full reopening. I think there is going to be a very gradual reopening, because it's not in the authorities' interest to do it overnight or very, very quickly. There are a lot of political sensitivities in that respect. So I think there's going to be a very gradual reopening. We also have the very comprehensive property package, which is putting a floor underneath property prices, which will release some consumption impact via the wealth effect. It potentially is going to start putting some upside pressure on Chinese imports. But you know what? I think the genie is out of the bottle as far as China is concerned.
What do you think the best China proxy is to push that view through?
Euro-China upside. And the reason for that is at the initial stage of the gradual reopening, you're going to see an increase in inputs by China, which just means that you're going to have a deterioration in the current account of China. And on the flip side, you're going to start having a positive impact on the current account of the Eurozone. And in general, everything that basically increases activity from China and Asia more generally, is going to be good for the euro. So euro-China, I think, would be my best trade for expressing that.
Can you pair this into what you were talking about earlier about the housing market and how that dictates the future of certain nations? And you point to Sweden and the UK. Translate, walk us through how a very weak housing market, what kind of deterioration you're expecting to really bleed into currency weakness?
Well, as far as the a direct impact, that's a direct impact into economic growth, and therefore there is direct impact to consumption, and there's direct impact, therefore, to central bank decisions. The Bank of England is very much aware of the properties in the housing market, and that's why it puts a lot of weight on growth right now, and that is why it seems unlikely, at least to us, that it's going to validate market expectations. Now, why these places are much more vulnerable, I mean, in the UK, you have to understand, in vast comparison, great difference with the US, where here you have 30-year fixed-rate mortgages. In the UK, you have 2-year to 5-year fixed-rate mortgages, which means at every point in time, you get a bigger percentage of the population going out there to refinance. So, just compare it. You have had about 2.5% mortgage rates in the past 10 years. Right now, you're potentially going to gravitate to 6.5% to 7%. So it's going to be a major, major hit.
It's going to be brutal. You see it in the numbers already. UK mortgage approvals.
Yes.
I think the lowest since COVID-19. How bad do you think this is going to get in the housing market in the UK?
My view is that it's going to get very bad. And the other issue that the UK is now facing is that it's actually facing a more structural problem into the inflation outlook compared to the rest of the world. And the reason for that, we've said that, I think it's to a large extent related to Brexit. And as a result of this, it will put the Bank of England in a much, much more difficult spot compared to other central banks. It will be faced with a structurally higher inflation and a much faster deteriorating economy.
Governor Bailey speaking a little bit later this morning, 10 a.m. Eastern time.
Yeah, to the House of Lords. And how much does he discuss the ramifications on a housing market that could be decimated, but not just because of interest rates, but also just because
of the general economy?
And did you see Goldman Sachs moving some of their employees of London to Milan, partly because of this?
But look, I think what was really unprecedented was during the last press conference by the Bank of England. Bailey actually said, I hope that the market is getting the message and mortgage rates are going to go lower after an interest rate hike.
I found it confusing from the Bank of England at times. I don't know. Vasilis Janakis of Citi. It's great to catch up, sir.
Thank you. Thanks.
Wonderful.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.